So this is the fifth day of our seven-day Southern Dharma 2010 silent retreat. And we will continue today with the Vimalakirti Sutra, profound dialogue between Vimalakirti and Manjushri. We have time today, we'll see Sariputra gets in the act. And, well, we'll see, you know. For those of you who weren't here last year, Sariputra is sort of the fall guy in this drama. Kind of keeps putting his foot in his mouth, but it's all for a good cause. So there are a few questions before we go on. Let me see if I can look at them. How do we, Buddhism, reconcile non-attachment with the research which states that attachment is a necessary part of well-being throughout life? Again, I'm not sure what this refers to, whether this is the childhood stuff, infant stuff of attachment, or it says with non-attachment, which states it. You know, it's interesting. You know, one of the problems, Western psychology has a good understanding of the ego and the pathological ways that the ego creates suffering for itself. But again, it doesn't have the profound view of Dharma, because it doesn't go beyond an ego. It never questions the existence of an ego or a self. So it's again, it's very helpful in a certain way for people to who exist solely within the realm of believing in their own self-existent, believing in the permanent solidity of selfhood. So again, you know, as someone who spent his professional life in the mental health field, I think there's a lot of wisdom there. But it's not the wisdom of Buddhism. It's not the wisdom of people, you know. These are people in my field, who have been outside the mind looking at it, analyzing, judging, comparing, labeling, assessing, but have never looked into their own minds and have never had a technology of how to do it and never really had a profound roadmap that Buddhism gives. So we can say in the development of a self, attachment may play some role, but it's like a lot of, I would say, things of, attachment's a funny word. Because a lot of times, and it's interesting, for many years in Buddhist translations, it would be translated as detachment. Right? And we could say attachment and detachment are somewhat opposites. And so one could think, Buddhism teaches detachment, which implies, disinterest, indifference, I'm just detached from anything. This is not Buddhism at all. Non-attachment is really teaches us how to relate freely. How to attach but not be attached. I mean, it sounds a little, in words, it gets a little confusing, but this is really what it means. It doesn't mean that someone who's a Buddhist practitioner can't have meaningful, deep relations with people. It means because of their capacity to understand the nature of phenomena and the nature of self and the nature of how the mind operates, they can do it without the pitfalls that most people get into, who either swing before, you know, attachment means, which means holding on, or a kind of detached indifference, which, you know, prevents one to be a normal human being with normal feelings. Anyhow, let somebody brighter than myself deal with that at a deeper level. Teacher, last night you asked me to ask myself, what is it when a feeling such as sadness comes up? So I asked myself, what is this? But now I'm stuck. If I keep asking that without the thinking mind, can you help? Yep, here we are again. We can't think our way out of this, guys. You know, it's like when your car is stuck in the mud, you know, the more you spin the wheels, the deeper you're going to get. The very things that ensnare us, we think will free us. So, the question, the very profound Zen koan, what is this? Doesn't mean to go here. If I, you know, again, the answer to, for me, in what is this, is not, oh, it's a flower. Right? What does that tell me? It's a flower. All right, on to the next. This is a book. This is a thermos. Can't, you know, here we go. All right. You know, so I've labeled everything. Now what? Do I know anything about anything? Do I know Ken? Because I label him Ken? I don't know anything. If anything, somehow, because I've labeled him, I can use that as a way of not knowing him. Oh, I know Ken. You know, he's Ken, and he's 6 foot something, and he's a psychiatrist. Oh, I know Ken. Those are words. And we fool ourselves because we think, because we can describe things in words and label things in words, that we know anything. So if I want to know this flower, I don't have to know what it's called. You know, there are people, you walk around and they're always going, what's that called? You know, they go out in the woods, what's that called? What's that called? What's the name of that bird? You know what I mean? It's like before they even stop to be with it, they right away want to go, let me label it, as if that's going to tell them something. Right? What does that tell you? If you want to know this, what this is, you have to stop. And you have to look. And you can touch. And you can smell. And you may have no idea what it's called. But you know what this is. And then the teacher will often say, don't call it a flower. What is it? Ask the student, don't call it a flower. What is it? People are dumbfounded. Oh, my God. Because right away we go to our heads and we want a label. So what is this is that question. If I don't label it, what is this? If I want to know a feeling that has arisen into me and I want to know what this is, I have to what? I have to enter it. How do I enter a feeling? I have to let it, I have to totally be it, feel it, experience it. Right? It's really quite simple. And then, you know, if there's some, if you want to know more about, you know, where that feeling is originating from, let's say in a more a content way, you just ask it. You know, why are you here? Why are you here? That's all. It'll tell you. You have to be willing to stop and enter it fully and listen to it. People make the mystery of self-discovery to be something very difficult. It's really very easy. You just have to stop and be present. And just to ask simple questions. The way you would with a child. Hold the child to you, and you know, what are you sad about, my dear? What are you angry about, my dear? What is scaring you, my dear? Right? Just like that. And if the child feels held and safe and loved, it will tell you. It's not a big deal. So, you know, when you are looking into your self, feelings, thoughts, just be present. Be totally open. And then, of course, as we've learned from Vimalakirti and Manjusri, what is this also can take us much deeper than content. What is a feeling? We say things like, I'm sad. Is there really a thing called sadness? Something solid. Something that exists. Something that is not made up of other things. What is a feeling? What is a thought? What is a concept? What is a label? Like flowers in air, the third patriarch says. Fred, you gave a very deep teaching today, which I want to thank you for, and one that was provocative. You spoke about there being no end to awareness. I have learned, or am in the process of learning, that the sine qua non of my Buddhist practice is direct experience. What was presented today was about the unknowable. I have been taught regarding Dharma to hear it, reflect on it, and practice it. I would appreciate some assistance of guidance. How can I avoid the pitfalls of dogma and faith? So I imagine what the person is asking is if I am, if Buddhism says that every teaching is to be heard, reflected on, and then practiced, if there is something that I do not know to be true, such as I have no, let's say this person says, I have no direct experience of unbounded awareness. How do I not make that a dogma? Or pitfalls of dogma and faith. Again, I think the pitfalls of dogma and faith are blindness, right? Blind dogma, blind faith. Buddhism certainly presents a view encodified in its sutras, in its teachings, in its Abhidhamma, psychological teachings, and it's a practice, so it certainly does have a full load of teachings. But I think what prevents it from being dogma is, as this person he refers, the Buddha said, as he spoke, he said to his disciples, you know, this is not dogma. Do not accept what I say because you respect me or you love me or because I'm the Buddha or anything like that. He said, you know, you need to, you know, like an assayer who assays the quality of minerals, you need to take these teachings and run them through your intellect. Now here it doesn't mean your projections. Doesn't mean, you know, I'm going to run through my issues. I'm just going to mix it up with all my delusive, ignorant, and wrong views and see if I make sense of it. You know, I mean, that's what a lot of people do. No, it means, you know, I'm really going to subject it, you know, is this rational? Right? Is this rational? Is this logical? Does this really flow from that, you know, in a logical way that's readily understandable? So again, you know, if your mind is so distorted that rationality and logic is beyond your ken, you know, you may have to just accept it on faith for a while. But I think many people have the capacity of putting aside all their projections and their issues in this case. And then he says, you know, does it accord with your experience? No, either that's prior experience, so when you're looking at things like the Four Noble Truths and things like that, three marks of existence, you would go, yeah. When you look at teachings on suffering, when you look at teachings on impermanence, et cetera, preciousness of life, et cetera, you go, yes, that makes sense, that is logical, and that is my experience and the way I've... I looked around the world at other people, and that seems to make sense. Okay, then you practice it, and now you'll have more experience to go on. Because if it is true, then you have to, and if it says if you do this, this, and this, then you'll experience this, this, and this, and this has to be the case. But again, you know, and you've heard me say this before, those of you around, there is a major article of faith in especially the Zen and the Zen of the Mahayana and the Dzogchen, the great perfection teachings of the Vajrayana, which are the traditions that I'm most familiar with, not to say it's not in others. And that is... the Buddha statement and all the great master statements that we are all inherently Buddhas. That we have this totally pure, whole, unstained nature that is as pure as unstained and adamantine, diamond-like, means unbreakable, always and ever and will be. And that no matter what your condition of life and what your conditions in life have been, and no matter how dirty and sullied your mind may feel to you, it is only covering up this pure nature. And so that is for many people because that is not their experience. In the same way, when they look in their mind, they see a mess. They don't see this vast, spacious arena of emptiness, right? So you kind of have to accept that one on faith. Now, over time, every now and then the clouds will lift. Every now and then something will occur that will convince you that maybe it is true. Or maybe sometimes when you hear teachings on your true mind, even though you don't have a direct experience of it, there's something about those words that call you. It's almost like some ancient song that you heard years ago or lifetimes ago. Something awakens in you, your own Bodhi seed, your own Buddha seed hears. But again, you know, you got to trust somebody in this life. And, you know, I would say in Buddhism it said, if you're going to trust somebody, trust a worthy object. So if you're going to trust somebody, trust the Buddha. Maybe this is the Buddha worthy object. Is the patriarchal lineage, as you read about them and their lives and their experiences, their realizations, the way they lived. Do you feel, do you believe, yeah, these are pure beings. I mean, who's going to write this stuff? Right? This is not copy. You know, this is not, you know, somebody who came out of, with a master's degree in English literature. Right? Who's going to write this stuff? If not somebody profoundly awakened. Right? And why would they write it? Unless they wanted to. You know, I mean, they don't have any royalties, do they? There's no royalties here. They're not making any money. Why would they write it? Right? If they didn't want to share something so profound and wonderful that they themselves discovered. And you know, over and over again, right? They say it. This way and that way, and you know. Why do they do that? They must have better things to do. It's because they have discovered this profound jewel, this profound, meaningful way to live a life. So, you know, you have to have faith. But it's a faith, not a blind faith. Like somebody says, well, just follow me on blind faith. I mean, again, think the way I'm saying. You know, think, who are these people? You know, who was the Buddha? What was his realization? And then how did he live his life for the next 9 years? Right? So read his life as it's come down to us. And read the lives of the masters. Right, read the life of the Dalai Lama, read the life of Thich Nhat Hanh, read the life of other masters, you know. Do these seem like authentic people? Right. Are these really rare human beings? And then if you believe that is so, then trust them. Trust their teaching. Right. To trust them doesn't mean you turn over your life and say, you know, well, tell me what to do now. You know, should I eat this or that? Right? We don't need their guidance for everything. We need their guidance in what? In Dharma. Right? Dharma is, we take refuge in the Dharma, we say, right? You know, and on our last morning, which is coming up, we'll have a recitation or a transmission of the mindfulness trainings, the three refuges. Every morning here we say what? I take refuge in the Buddha. Right, Dharma Sangha, right. What does that mean? this is where I go, you know. Storms of life, storms of my mind, storms of relationship, right? Where can I find refuge? I can find refuge in the Buddha, in the teacher. The teacher is a constant support and reminder of the truth. I can take refuge in her, I can take refuge in him. There is a teacher, there are teachings, the Dharma. And I have reflected on them. I have seen the benefit they seem to bring to other people's lives. It seems quite practical. A lot of it is understandable, some of it not quite. I can go to that for guidance in this life. Right. And then the community of practitioners. You know, and in Buddhist tradition, the Mahayana tradition, there are two communities. There's the ordinary Sangha, and then there is the Mahasangha, the Arya Sangha. The ordinary Sangha is your community of fellow practitioners. And you know, Buddhism, some people go, gee, there are a lot of unhealthy people in this Sangha. A lot of kind of whacked out people. It's a wide door. To me, Buddhism is like a restaurant, you know. You can't control who comes. You know. But everybody who is in our community is here because they're hungry. Because they're hungry. Hungry. Like in the restaurant. So, that's it. But over time, if the people in the community take refuge, true refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma practice, as it's said in the verse, the community will become a community of harmony, a community of wisdom, a community of true fellowship, companionship, liberation. The Arya Sangha traditionally means it's sort of like those people who have realization. Some degree of direct experience and transformation through the practice of the teachings. And, I think as a community matures and becomes a true Sangha, there has to be a core of Mahasangha, Arya Sangha. Because in the Zen tradition and in the meditative traditions, realization of the teachings, direct experience and realization of the teachings is what's key. Right? It has to be authentic. Can't just be intellectual and conceptual. We need people at the center of our Sangha who knows that this is not a flower. It's just called a flower. Who know their minds. And who have done a fair degree of work to rid themselves of the contaminant of self-centeredness. Narcissism, egocentricity, has given up their absolute complete belief in the reality of their thoughts, beliefs, who can tell the difference between reality and projections about reality, and are no longer grasping so completely at phenomena. So some degree of understanding. Is the people in the Mahasangha, the Arya Sangha. So it's like that. And if you have all that, I think you can avoid the pitfalls of dogma and blind faith. See the chanting book? Yeah, just the plum. No, I know. I mean, the one we do in the morning, right? Continuing from non-dogma, non-blind faith. When we do our touching the earth, the prostrations, and we touch the earth, we bow, we prostrate, to these Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and ancestral teachers. And what are we up to? And why are we doing it? Again, as you know, touching the earth, prostrating, is just simply a way of showing deep respect. Right? In Asian countries where Buddhism developed, when you greet somebody, you bow to them. You put your hands together and you bow to them out of respect. I mean, just in meeting people. And for something of deep respect, you would touch the ground, right? And, you know, people would touch the ground before the emperor, before nobility, before the patriarch of their family, before their parents, right? So it was already in the culture. And then it was just brought into the Buddhist temple. Right? So these are just forms of respect and gratitude. But there's also, I think, something in a when we kind of get down. You know, usually we're vertical, but I think it's when we get horizontal. When we get down close to the ground and touch it, there is kind of a submission, but not in a submitting to dominance. I think there's kind of a submission which is like an openness. In that posture, one is just very open and close to the earth. And so in that posture, we touch all the aspects of our own enlightened capacity. That's what we're enumerating. So the Buddha is the teacher. So we prostrate before that capacity to live a life of awareness and teach in the very midst of suffering and confusion. To that capacity that is exemplified in a Buddha, but that we want to begin to nourish in ourselves, and we prostrate. We prostrate to Manjusri, cutting through ignorance, awakening our minds, our hearts. That is the wisdom aspect of bodhisattvas, enlightened beings, but it's also acknowledging that capacity within ourselves, within our own mind. Samanta Bahadura is. Samanta Bahadura is like the workhorse, right? Working joyfully, working. He's just very active. It's enlightened action. Whatever he does with great happiness, with great joy, but he is indomitable energy in his service of beings That's Samanta Bahadra, the Bodhisattva of great action. A Bhaktisvara, as you know, is love and compassion. This wonderful open heart to all beings that hears deeply their pain and suffering, their difficulties, and reaches out with her 10,000 arms to help in any way can. And then Maitreya, the Buddha to be born. You know, in Buddhism there are these world cycles, 2,400 years world cycles, and you know, Buddha Shakyamuni, there have been Buddhas before him that are enumerated, and there will be Buddhas after him, and Maitreya is considered the Buddha in waiting. And Maitreya really means that capacity, that seed of awakening that's in all beings. Who knows? Maybe one of us here will be the next Buddha. Why? Because the seed, the Bodhi seed, is already in us. So that reminds us of that. And then, of course, the stream, the ancestral teachers, showing the way fearlessly and compassionately. What does that mean, they're fearless? They're fearless in what way? They teach the law. They teach the Dharma. They teach the truth without any fear of what? Of how they're going to be judged or what people are going to think about. I mean, they're fearless. They teach the truth, whether you want to hear it or not. They have that kind of courage, the teachers, to speak the truth. But also they speak the truth because of their compassion. They see our suffering. They see our ignorance. They see our delusion. They see our topsy-turvy thinking. Right, and they want to help. But they often speak to us in ways that unsettle us. They hold up the mirror to our foolishness, to our delusions, to our stupidity, to our arrogance, to our egocentricity, right? And a lot of us aren't comfortable with that, right? We'd be scared of doing that for somebody, or else we'd have a lot of ego involved in it. But the teachers, there's no ego. They have nothing invested. Right? They only want to help. They want to cut away people's delusions, so they can be free. So anyhow, good practice, not dogmatic. So let us return to Vimalakirti's empty room. We see for a sick man, he certainly has a way with words. He's obviously feeling a little better. So do you remember yesterday the source of illness was troublesome entanglements? Please remember, that's a great word, troublesome entanglements. Just watch how you entangle yourself and how they become troublesome. By realizing that there is nothing to grasp at, when one ceases to grasp at anything, there will be no more troublesome entanglements. So at the end of this section, Vimalakirti says, Manjusri, this is how the ailing bodhisattva should go about regulating and controlling his mind. By doing so, he cuts off the sufferings of old age, sickness, and death. If he fails to do so, then all his religious practice and accomplishments in the past will be void of wisdom or profit. A person who has overcome a sworn enemy deserves to be called a hero In the same way, one who is cut off sickness, old age, and death may be called a bodhisattva. So next, this ailing bodhisattva should also think to himself, this illness of mine has no reality, no existent, and this we've already been talking about for 4 or 5 days now, what that means. And the illnesses of other living beings likewise have no reality and no existence. Okay? So again, this is the mind of the, you know, this is how we step into the mind of the bodhisattva, right? Not only, you know, again, having looked deeply into the causation, et cetera, of their own illness and what is causing it, and also how to free themselves up and liberate themselves from those causes of illness and become a well-being. They look around and go, well, the illnesses of everyone else is the same. They also have no reality and no existence, right? When he adopts his view, she should conceive a great compassion. Now, when he adopts his view, okay, so this is important, okay. So, again, this is the view of the bodhisattva. Not only acknowledges their own delusion and their own suffering, but notices that all the other beings that they are associated with also are suffering this topsy-turvy mind. Right? Their mother, their father, their sisters, their brothers, right? Their friends, their family, their children. Right? They look around the world, wider and wider and wider, and see that this world of troublesome entanglements and grasping after phenomena, clinging and grasping, projecting, endlessly lost in the kind of issues that come from this way of living, they see it's just going on everywhere. Can't talk to anybody who doesn't have an issue. So the bodhisattva realizes that. I'm not alone. And all my brothers and sisters on this planet, all other life suffers the same types of delusions. So when she adopts this view of other beings having the same issues, she should conceive a great compassion that is marked by affection. That when she adopts a view, if she conceives a great compassion that is marked by affection and concern for living beings, she should at once thrust it aside. Okay? I will. I'll say it several times. It's very, very interesting. Okay. When this bodhisattva looks and sees the suffering of other beings and has this compassionate response, which in Buddhism means I want to relieve them of their suffering, help. If at the same time that compassion is marked by affection and concern for living beings, it should be thrust aside. Why? You were anticipated. Why? Right? Because we go, no, right? We like to be affectionate to beings, right? We're supposed to be concerned about them. Isn't that what we've been taught, right? Yeah, we don't like this. Taking all the fun out of life. We like people to be affectionate to us, don't we? And we like people to be concerned about us, don't we? Yeah. What is this? We right away, we go, what's going on here? I don't like this. Why did Fred read this part? Why couldn't he just skip it over it? Right? It's very interesting. Why? Because the bodhisattva must rid himself of all earthly passions caused by external defilement when he summons up his great compassion. If her compassion is marked by affection and concern, then she will have feelings of weariness and revulsion toward the realm of birth and death. But if he can put aside affection and concern, she will feel no weariness and no revulsion. Whatever realm he or she happens to be born into, he or she will not be blinded by affection or concern. Very interesting. It's interesting because when I was looking at this, I thought, interesting, you know, because it's actually, you know, let's say in my training as a therapist, right? Well, certainly to be motivated by a concern for the suffering of others is the aspiration. We are told what? Yeah, don't get personally involved with people, right? You know, that's a barrier you shouldn't cross when you go home at night, don't spend your evening thinking about your clients, right? Don't step out of the boundaries of the relationship. You know, don't go visit them in their home. Don't go take care of their kids, right? You're there to alleviate their suffering, but you're not there to develop a personal relationship. If you do, what happens? You contaminate the relationship, but also what? You weary yourself. You know, one of the things that's interesting when I was involved with training new therapists, I mean, you know, that was, you know, they all get burnt out because it's always on their mind. It becomes very personal for them, right? They take on the stories of their clients. They worry about them. You know, and if you do that, your effectiveness, your capacity to really be there for them in a very focused, energetic way. So I thought this was interesting. 2,500 years ago, they knew how to train people in the helping professions. You know? I mean, it's really, I thought, quite profound. Again, it's like, if you're a physician and you're going to the hospital to check on the patients, you go from one room to another. And in every room you go to, you are, you know, you are concerned about their suffering and you are doing everything you can to help them, right? But you're not becoming good friends with everybody and, you know, hey, when you get to the hospital, you know, you don't give me your home phone number and your address. Stop, you know, and, you know, before you know it, what? You know, the cars will be lined up and down the street. Everybody, you know, you don't create a personal relationship with everybody. You're there to help. It would be wearying. It would be exhausting. You could be overwhelmed by it, couldn't you? Right? It's interesting. Said, you know, you'll develop a revulsion. Right? Right? I mean, if you're a physician and you're around sick people 8, 10, 12 hours a day, you need a break. Right? You know? Right? You need a break so you can nourish yourself, so you can have balance. Because if you don't, you know, people in the helping professions, you know, burnout, people. And burnout means people get what? Not only stressed and tired, but people become what? Distant, they become indifferent, they become callous, they become, right? All these kinds of things develop, right? They get overwhelmed, they get depressed, everybody's sick, I'm around sick people all the time, you know? All these kinds of stuff. So it's interesting, right? Yeah. So, again, if you take up, you know, this is not, this is a bodhisattva, okay? This is not saying, you know, in your role as a, in your family, in your very personal relations, not to have any affection or concern. For those who went, I knew Buddhism had something like this in it, you know. saying, if you seriously undertake the career of a bodhisattva, that you are going to dedicate your life to being truly of aid to sentient beings and to work ceaselessly for their liberation. Right? If that is your career, and you know, for those of you who are in our intensive on Santi Deva's Bodhicaratara, we know the bodhisattva life is called a career. It's a job. And if you sign up to be a bodhisattva, they're saying you cannot personalize every encounter, or you will burn out. So there has to be some professional distance. Right? There has to be boundaries. Right? There has to be balance. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, this is, you know, 2,500 years ago, and yet seemed to have a great wisdom about what it means to be a helping professional. Again, you know, in a certain way, certain aspects of what it means to be a bodhisattva, even though in the Buddhist context it's not just only a selfless service to suffering, it has this a great wisdom teaching component of liberation in it. So it really goes beyond you know, health professionals and mental health professionals and other people who are in service alleviating people's suffering. It's the same context. I remember when I first met Thich Nhat Hanh, and he was talking about the development of the School of Youth for Social Service in Vietnam in the 60s, which was his organization during the war, mostly of high school and college age students, to provide social services. Especially to areas of the Vietnamese community, rural areas and poverty areas, and just areas just were not being served in any way. And when he told me about all they did, which was so radical and revolutionary for his society, I went, "Oh, that's social work." Oh yeah. You know, I mean, that's been a profession, a career. Here since, what, the 1880s or something, Jane Addams or all that stuff, right? I mean, it was just interesting. So in certain ways, you know, this this bodhisattva way is you know, in various pieces in our society. People do take up lives where they are actively working to alleviate suffering. As I say, the bodhisattva is just kind of, from the Buddhist point of view, or the human point of view, the most profound, because it wants to go to the root, right? In other words, Vimalakirti, he talks about the cause of disease, and he's called a great physician, but he doesn't hold a medical license, right? I mean, he's not working at the level of symptomology or simply the etiology of specific disease entities. He's looking much deeper, right? At what causes ill-being in human beings. Their being is not well. There's illness in our being. Vimalakirti, Dharma, is medicine for the places where our being is ill. It's like that. So it doesn't mean, you know, you don't go to the doctor or take your prescriptions as prescribed for certain symptoms and diseases. But the bodhisattva can put aside affection and concern, will feel no weariness or revulsion. whatever realm he happens to be born into, he will not be blinded by affection or concern. And this is also a characteristic of bodhisattvas, right? They appear in different realms, right? In the same way, each of us may find our life situation different. But wherever we are, whatever life situation we find ourselves in, we have capacity to alleviate suffering. Right now, we're in a very delightful realm, aren't we, here? Right? We're like in a deva realm, and the six realms, these are deva realms, right? So we're all here, it's quite lovely, right? It's quite easy, delicious. You know what I mean? This is called a heavenly realm in the six realms of existence, right? It's just quite, everything is easy. We got staff, you know, Donna's down there, and her staff is cooking up stuff for us, you know. We don't have to do much, chop a few vegetables. Even that's kind of sweet, people. You know, it's all kind of, right? You know, it rains, we pop up our umbrellas, you know, it's, right? It's like that, right? Dharma is just, we just sit here and it comes forth for us. So it's, this is a heavenly realm. So this is, you know, those of us who are here, we've had good fortune, you know, because this is an easy job. But there are the jobs that are more difficult. I was speaking to somebody the other day who works in, underserved, underprivileged mental health clinics with very disturbed, angry, aggressive people. Right? My response to that was, you know, you work in a hell realm. Hell realms are places of great great anger, great violence, great delusion, great pain and suffering. It's hell realm. Some of us may find ourselves in those kinds of realms where there are lots of beings like that. That may be our calling in this life. Right? Many years ago in my career, I worked in an adolescent facility. I used to say, it's a hell realm. You know, 50, 60 of these kids, angry, untrusting, deceitful, you know, couldn't deal with kindness, couldn't deal with love, twisted, turned, took advantage of it, you know. It was a hell realm. So there are all kinds of realms like that, hungry ghost realms. Right, which is people are incredibly dissatisfied and greedy. And, right, more, need, want. Right? We may find ourselves in those kinds of realms. We may find ourselves in animal-like realms. People are just dumb. You know? Meaning that, realms where just people have no insight into themselves, no understanding of life. They're just kind of banging around in it, living for the moment, drinking, drugging, you know, rutting around, just like that, you know, no aware of consequences, just like animals, right? And then there are lots of realms like that, right? Human realms, you know, and then there are higher realms where, the realms of the Titans, you know, where it's all about fame and power, and me, and power over, and, you know, moving up the ladder and getting power over other people, is all what it's about. realms of aggression, but oftentimes subtle aggression, but very egocentric realms, Titan realms. And then there are Deva realms where it's just all about the pursuit of pleasure and luxury and ease and celebrity and fame and all that, you know, being noticed, highly narcissistic realms. So again, we may find ourselves, according to our own individual karma, where life takes us in these various realms. And if we have taken refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and if we have clarity, and we can see and not be fooled by the outer trappings of these realms, but see the inherent suffering of the beings in them, we will perhaps have opportunity to be of help. So whatever realm she happens to be born into will not be blinded by affection or concerns. It's interesting. Next says, he is not bound by the conditions of his birth and hence is able to preach the Dharma for living beings and liberate them from their bonds. As the Buddha has said, if one is in bonds oneself, to suppose that one can free others from their bonds is hardly reasonable. But if one frees oneself of bonds, it is perfectly reasonable to assume that they can free others as well. Therefore, the bodhisattva must not conjure up bonds for him or herself. Okay? Is not bound by the conditions of one's birth. Now again, I would imagine it could have, you know, because, you know, when the time these teachings were being developed in India, these were very stratified societies, caste-based societies. And in those types of highly hierarchical societies, one was clearly bound by the conditions of where one was born. And we know that one of the revolutionary aspects of the Buddhist Sangha, and which also made the Buddha unliked by the, which is mild, unliked, hated, vilified by the holders of the Brahmin caste system, was that he accepted into his Sangha all castes. And his Sangha had both people of high caste, Brahmin caste, warrior caste, tradesman caste, and also had untouchables in his Sangha. And you also know, not only did he have men in his Sangha, but he had women in his ordained Sangha. And so, you know, so I think that was the context of this teaching. But I think for us today, it has a deeper thing. Because many of us feel bound by the conditions of our birth. Meaning that we are bound, our minds are bound, our emotions are bound. Our sense of our own capacity and efficacy as human beings has been tied, bound by conditions of family, environment that we were born into, and that we have significantly identified ourselves with. And so there may be many people, even sitting here, who may feel that my capacity to realize the Dharma, my capacity to awaken, and my capacity to teach, to preach the Dharma for living beings and liberate them from their bonds, I cannot do. I am too screwed up, too messed up. Too neurotic, too damaged, too wounded, you know, like that. So these are, this is what it means by being bound by conditions of your birth. And as he says here, if one is in bonds, how can you free somebody else from their bonds? All you can do is talk it. Right? But you have no experience yourself of the work. Right? When you have done the work, when you have clearly accepted the conditions of your birth, when you have clearly seen the chains that imprison you, and you have undone all those troublesome entanglements that was talked about earlier, right? When you are no longer caught by the conditions of your birth, then you speak with authenticity, right, to other people. That when other people come to you with their stories about their life, with their stories about who and what they are because of what happened to them, you listen, but you realize one doesn't need to be bound by the stories we tell ourselves of who and what we are. But if you have not freed yourself, you cannot speak that and act on that with true authenticity. So as the Buddha has said, if one is in bonds oneself, we cannot suppose that we will have the capacity to free others from their bonds. But if one frees oneself from these bonds, it is perfectly reasonable to assume that I can free the bonds of others. Right? Now, that doesn't also mean that I just have the capacity of helping people who have the same exact bonds that I had. Right? It means you know about bonds. You know how they bond you. And whether you have the bond of... What are the bonds that people have? Bound by... bonds of inadequacy. Bound by... the bonds of feeling unlovable, unworthy, ineffective, small, little, scared, you know, whatever bonds, I'm to this, I'm to that, these are all the bonds, but they're all just bonds. They're all self-created bonds, created by the mind, created by cause and conditions, right? So it's just simple, you know, if I'm in prison, you know, if this was a prison, right? And we were all chained to the walls, you know, like in Les Miserables, you know, if we're all just chained to the wall, right? You know, we can talk about it, but can't get out, right? But if one person gets the key, right, and it can unlock themselves, then they can go around and unlock the bonds of everybody else. But somebody's got to get the key. Right? So that's the Buddha, that's the teachers. It not only, you know, if Bill has the key, but he can't figure out how to open his shackles, right? I think that's probably more like the state of a lot of us, right? You know, we got the bonds, we got the key, we're just struggling, you know, to get can't quite, you know what I mean? You know how sometimes you get the key, but it's just not turning in the lock, right? Or we can't get it in, or you know. It's like that, right? So, you know, we got the bonds, we got the Buddha Dharma Sangha, we got the key, and then we got to practice the unbonds. Now we go, oh, what? Like what we were talking about earlier with that question about, you know, now I know what. The key works. This is the right key. Bill's all excited, right? You see? And he's just undone his shackles. He's happy, right? He's about to make it for the door. But But he's a bodhisattva. He looks around. See, this is like what happens. He looks around and goes, look, they're all still here, right? Ken, you know, I've been sitting next to him in this prison, you know, for 20, 30 years, eating gruel, and right? You know what I mean? Been sharing the same fate. Can I just go out the door? Can you, Bill? Can you just go out the door and leave Ken?
Nah.
And what? It's like that, right? Freeze Ken. Bill and Ken say, let's go. But then Ken goes, but how about, you know? Before you know it, you've released everybody. And because you're a bodhisattva, you said, you go out the door first, right? You undo Ken, you say, Ken, go, I'll get the others. You don't just think about yourself. So that's the bodhisattva. The bodhisattva makes a commitment to stay. As long as there are people in bonds, the bodhisattva will stay. Most of us go, you know, run out the door, throw the key. Hey, guys. You know, they pick it up. They don't. All you care about is getting out the door. Bodhisattva says, no, I'm going to go around. I'll unlock it. Show them how to do it. Right? So it's like that. But if one has freed oneself of bonds, it is perfectly reasonable to assume that one can free the bonds of others. Therefore, the bodhisattva must not conjure up bonds for oneself. Conjure. Interesting word, isn't it? Conjure up. Conjure up means what?
Magic.
Magic. Make it up. Right, make it up. There might be people sitting in this room who've conjured up all kinds of reasons why they can't do this and can't do that. Can't be free, can't be liberated, can't be happy. It's because they believe that the bonds of their childhood, their bonds of their conditioning, the bonds of their personality, the bonds of whatever, are somehow fixed, permanent, enduring, right? They don't realize that they're just conditions. And what do we know about conditions? They're all subject to change. They're all just variables. So we all have a certain mind. Now I'm speaking in the relative sense. That has been created by causes and conditions, patterns of thinking, patterns of feeling, patterns of reacting, patterns of personality, right? But they are not fixed. Because how can I say they are not fixed? Because there is nothing fixed. Right? If you can see how the causes and conditions of your childhood have affected you, then you can certainly see how if you introduce other causes and conditions in your life, that can affect you too. Right? Why do those early ones have to be the primal cause of your existence? Especially now that you're older and more capable of introducing more consciously causes and conditions that really benefit you. Right? When you were a child, you just had to go along. Right? But now you're an adult. Right? You can introduce, you can expose yourself to all types of causes and conditions that have the capacity of changing you and transforming you in the way you want to be. Now again, I mean, that doesn't mean, some people, I guess, have the capacity of radical transformation, but most of us, I think, have the capacity of enough transformation that it'll make a significant difference. Right? So it doesn't mean, everybody with two left feet can become, world-class ballroom dancers, right? But it means you could probably learn how to dance, right? Enjoy the music, enjoy the movement, like that. Do not conjure up bonds. Please look deeply into that. Please look deeply into the stories you carry about who you are, and therefore the stories you carry about what you're capable of. This is living proof, right? That transformation is possible, healing is possible. But one has to take the medicine as prescribed. That's our problem, right? We don't take the medicine. People have been in Dharma settings 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years. Keep getting the same prescription. And just never take the medicine. What they call it, doctor shopping. There are people like that. They're spiritual teaching shopping. They go from one to another and get another prescription. Don't take it. Or only take it a little bit, or just take it the way they want, so they never get healthy. They never get free. Right. They go, oh, this doesn't work. I better go to another doctor, get another prescription. Right. Like that. Right. Find a good doctor that you trust. When he or she gives you the prescription, just follow it. Could it be as simple as that? So we will stop for today. I was asking Carol, so is the four kisses for continued rain, I mean that front you were talking about yesterday, is...
For today.
So it'll be off and on.
I want you to run out of space.
Thank you. Yeah, that's fine.